Going into this week, a number of people were expressing an interest in and a need for more discussion about how in our day-to-day lives as ordinary Christian folk, we can, in very practical ways, engage in the art and craft and life of peacemaking. So we decided that we would schedule a forum to talk about that. There's certainly no menu or certainly no complete cookbook that tells one how to live a life of peacemaking. But there is, I think, in this room, probably, a gathering of wisdom that we need to take advantage of. And all we want to do, I think, is to open up that discussion and have everybody here contribute notions about practical peacemaking in your own lives, in your own communities, in organizations. It can be, peacemaking can be seen as a personal kind of thing, something one does in one's own household, with one's own children, with one's own lifestyle. It can be seen as an institutional thing that one deals with on an organizational level in a number of areas, including the church. It can be seen as a national and international set of questions and arenas to act in. It's certainly the call of a peacemaker is one of the clearest, it seems to me, biblical calls that we have. So we need to deal with it. And we'll do that very informally. I'm going to ask each of four folks to say just a very few minutes worth of things about how they think in their own lives about practical peacemaking. And hopefully we'll get a variety of things in no particular systematic order out on the table and ask you all then to react to them and to add your own to the pile of peacemaking options that we've got on the table. Okay? So that's the sort of format. Let me start with Tim Kieschnick. We talked about there not being any particular recipe or cookbook for peacemaking, but if there were, Tim would write it. Tim, as you all know, is the village cook, but in his with his other hat on, is a peacemaker. Many of you have attended sessions that Tim has done on his position as a tax resister and as a pacifist. And Tim, why don't you just lead us into the ways in which you ask these questions of yourself in your own life?
I'll touch real briefly on just four areas that have been real key to me in my personal peacemaking. The first has always been to inform myself. This is something that I think everybody should do right from the start. You're reading books, periodicals, the daily newspaper from a fresh perspective, the Bible. These days there are lectures and movies everywhere. It's not hard to start looking into things a little deeper, and I think that's something that needs to happen at the beginning and all the way through a person's peacemaking, as well as making for myself the time to talk with other people and listen to them and think about these issues. The second is, I think it's very important, it has been for me, to connect up with a group. There are a lot of things you can do in a group that you can't do by yourself. You can get support from a few other people around you so that it becomes a little less likely for me to believe that I'm as crazy as people tell me I am sometimes if there are other crazy people with me. It can be a place for me to discuss these things with them. It's, at Holden and every place else I've been, it's very hard for me to talk about nuclear annihilation or the general war machine or anything with people. It tends to be a subject that's maybe a little too touchy or too scary. In a support group, it can be a place where we're free to talk about that, and it's very, very important. A group can also be a place where we can worship together, bring all these things together in the context of God and in the context of worship, and that's really important. A group can also help each of us get some initiative for some action. If I'm in the mood for starting something, it helps me to have some other people who are going to go along with me, and if I'm not in the mood for starting something, generally if I'm in a group, somebody else is in the mood for starting something, and I can follow along with that, and that's really good. In a group, we have more resources than we do alone, and we also have a lot more visibility, which is very important in becoming effective. Third, I think lifestyle has been a very important part of my peacemaking. I've I try to explore and to acknowledge the ways in which I'm complicit in the arms race and in my country's military buildup, and then to act in response to my complicity through to let that permeate my lifestyle as much as possible. This comes in both partly in terms of my personal interactions, so that I try to move from violence in my one-on-one interactions to nonviolence, reducing the sexism and the racism and the ageism and all of that that's a part of me that has become a part of my national culture and that has projected itself into the arms race. It's also been very important to me to look in my life at places where I'm actively complicit in the arms race and in my country's buildup, both in terms of my consumer habits, how when I buy something, when I wear a certain kind of clothes, when I drive a car, that has an impact on my country's foreign policy because my country's military is largely there to provide me with oil and with just the kinds of foods that I want and with the right kind of clothes made by cheap labor someplace else. And so just by my very consumer habits, I'm contributing in a lot of ways to the arms race, and I need to look at that and decide how that's going to impact on my buying and consuming habits. I'm also actively complicit in the arms race every time I pay a tax dollar, and I think that's something all of us have to look at. If I pay $1,000 in income taxes next year, that over $600 of that will go to the U.S. military, and about $100 of that will go to nuclear weapons. And each of us needs to ask, am I willing to pay that $100 a year to buy nuclear weapons? Do I want to own $100 worth of nuclear weapons? And how am I going to respond to that? I also have to look at my lifestyle, the places in which I'm tacitly complicit in the arms race. I think if all of us here completely withdraw from the arms race and sit quietly by ourselves, then we will all go quietly into nuclear destruction. And it's important for us to take a stand and to speak out at places even when there seems to be no immediate confrontation, no active complicity in the arms race. It's important to take the initiative to make that confrontation happen between justice and injustice and between peace and war. And when we do that, my fourth area is to try to match my actions with my words and to match both of those with seriousness of the situation. If the situation is something that I can take or leave, well, I'd really rather not have nuclear weapons, but you know, that's the way it goes, then I can maybe get away with writing a letter to Congress once a year, you know, a token letter once a year, that's fine. But I think that the situation that we're in now with nuclear weapons, with the U.S. military position in the third world, with the economic injustices in our own country and throughout the world, I think it's a drastic situation that we're in. It's a life-threatening and earth-shaking situation, and I think I need to match my actions to that situation. If it's a drastic situation like it is now, I need some drastic actions. One of the things that's meant for me in my attempt to become extreme as I can in those actions in order to match the situation, that's meant civil disobedience, in which I wanted to break the law, put myself in that kind of a vulnerable position, to take a risk. Some of the things that I'm saying in civil disobedience are that I'm standing in absolutely unequivocal opposition to the path that my government is taking. I'm on the other side. This is a matter of basic faith and conscience for me. And I'm not going to tolerate the status quo, and I'm willing to risk something in saying that I'm against the status quo. I'm saying that even though my country's military claims to be providing me with peace and security and freedom, that I reject that military, and that along with that, I'm also willing to reject the freedom and the security that it claims to give me. And I would prefer to stand in solidarity with other people from whom the government, my government, has stripped their freedom and their security. So those are some things that have impacted on me.
Mark, it seems, Tim, what we've got from you is a whole spectrum of possible reactions to the challenge to be a peacemaker, from education to group formation to all the way to civil disobedience of various kinds.
There's always something for anybody. Yeah. The important thing is to do something.
Right. Hillary Hamilton did something tonight in Vespers. From the quilt hanging on the front of the village center, in front of us in Vespers, to the
ways in which the children in Narnia this week have thought about themselves as peacemakers, as part of the vocation that Hillary has been sharing with everybody at the village. How are you with this question of peacemaking?
Well, first I have to say that I did one thing that was probably not real peacemaking tonight, because I forgot to have a prayer, and the little girl that was supposed to say the prayer was very upset with me. So that was probably not a good example of peacemaking in my forgetfulness. But this afternoon, after Jody asked me if I had say a few words tonight, I sat down and kind of thought about it, and mostly I made lists. And the first thing I thought when I thought about what do I do with children that are peacemaking kinds of activities, I thought that first and foremost, I feel that things for children need to be really practical and of their own world. And the first thing that came to mind was just remembering Piaget's research, which is that children don't begin to read reason abstractly, according to Piaget's research, until they're 12, 13, 14 years old. And up to that time, they're in a state of concrete reasoning, and things need to be really concrete for them. But this this idea of concrete reasoning, I feel, even extends further. And in a graduate class I took a few years ago, I learned that some research actually suggests, and this was a study that was done with population of college students, that in that study only 60% of the college population had actually reached the stage of abstract reasoning. And so I'm feeling that really across the board, and those of you who are college teachers may be able to substantiate that with your own practical experience, but I'm feeling like really across the board with children and with teenagers and with young adults and probably with adults on through their developmental life, that peacemaking activities for most of us, and I would probably include myself in the group that maybe is pretty concrete in my my ability to perceive and experience, that things do have to be pretty concrete. So then I guess the next thing I thought of was well, where are some times, I started making this list of where are some times for children that they need to really be practicing peacemaking, and so I started with getting on the school bus and riding the school bus and getting off the school bus and getting into the school building and how to treat new kids in the school and the school lunchroom, for any of you that have ever been in the school lunchroom, or it's probably a place to avoid. And obviously this list could go on. That really throughout a child's life and in their daily existence, there are many opportunities of them just needing to know how to behave peaceably with each other, with other children and with their teachers and with their families, kids in their neighborhood, and all of that. And so then the third kind of list I began to make or began to think about was, well, how do we sort of program for peace with children? And I found myself thinking that really most of it, in my opinion, comes from the kinds of things we do as adults. And so I'm feeling like one of the most important things that I do in trying to make peace with the students that I work with whom I work, is just modeling in my own behaviors appropriate peacemaking kinds of things, being polite and respectful and all of that kind of thing. And I can really notice a difference in my classes on the days when I'm feeling out of sorts and or whatever, you know, that suddenly they become more that way too. Another kind of practical thing that I do, or that I try to, is using positive verbalizations with children and really defining the behaviors that I am trying to reinforce, the peaceable kinds of behaviors. So instead of just saying, good job, Susie, or something, I'd say, Susie, I really like the way you said hello to the new kid in school and invited them to have lunch with you, or something like that. So that I'm trying to be really specific in the things that I say to children, so that they'll know what they're doing that is an appropriate kind of thing. Another thing that I try to do is something that I call redirecting. So if somebody is picking up a truck and throwing it across the room, instead of saying, don't throw that truck, I'll say something like, you can roll the truck across the room. So I'm trying to redirect them by redefining what the appropriate kinds of behaviors are. And I guess really, I think that in my role as a teacher, those kinds of verbalizations and the way that I structure my classroom environment is probably the most important thing I can do in practical peacemaking kinds of activities. I think another question that can be asked, or what are some specific activities we can do in terms of Christian education or education in school or something like that that will plan actual curriculum kinds of things for peacemaking. And so I brought just one book to share with you tonight that one of the women that I've been working with in Narnia in the last few weeks bought here at the Holden Bookstore. It's called Peacemaking Activities for Children. And it's a simple book that has little activities that can be done in 10 or 15 minutes that are activities that create a lot of classroom discussion about peace. This was one we did a couple of weeks ago where we gave the kids just sort of like this pyramid of little phrases was given to them sort of like a deck of cards. And they could arrange the pyramid in any way they thought, from the things that they thought were the most basic to the things that they thought were the most complex. And the things that were in this list were to learn people's names, to get to know people's families, to help people, to learn the truth, to ask what do you mean, to say who said that, to ask how do they know, to tell the truth, to care for God's earth, and to look at people the way God does. It was a nice activity because each one of these things is a peacemaking kind of activity. And yet there were a lot of different ways, and we had the group divided into two groups, and each group came up with their own slightly different opinions about the way they thought these peacemaking activities could be arranged. So all the answers were kind of right. And I'll just leave these up here, and if you'd like to come up and look at them at the end of the forum, you can.
That's certainly an example of abstract reasoning, it seems to me. And once you start dealing with the relationships among those 10 things, you're dealing with as much as any college students.
Yeah, it is. It was fairly abstract. For some of the kids, they had a lot of trouble with it. Mm-hmm. And we had to think of ways to make it more concrete, like, what do you think are the easiest of these things to do? And then they could look and say, well, learning people's names is a lot easier than looking at people the way God does, or something like that. So,
One thing people may want to get into a little bit later with Hillary is some of the very serious discussion that went on in the village last week about what to do with children when discussion among adults turns in a very concentrated way toward the nuclear issue. Kids were in tears in this village last week, fairly constantly. The village felt at a very deep level what it's like to be 7, 8, 5, 12, 14 under the shadow of the bomb, when the bomb is taken seriously by adults and not swept under the rug. So that there was a lot of very creative discussion about how that kind of talk can take place in a way that includes children, but that includes them in a way that keeps their hope alive and doesn't crush them. Hillary was at the center of those conversations this week too. You all know Ron Sider. Ron is, besides being an avid lecturer and fisherman and writer of all kinds of books, an avid peacemaker as well, and has been involved in peacemaking activities for these many decades. Which of the many do you want to just lay out briefly for us, Ron?
Well, before I focus on one specific thing, I want to just add a book that fits very much what Hillary is saying, that I'm pretty sure is in the bookstore, although I don't think I've seen it. Kathy and Jim McGinnis have a book called Parenting for Peace and Justice, and it's real mine. Mm-hmm. That is in the bookstore.
I've seen it before.
Yeah, it is.
Of the hundreds of ways of working for peace, I want to focus for just a very few minutes, one that I find myself increasingly excited about and drawn to in a powerful way, and that is using the techniques of nonviolent direct action to try to step between parties involved in violent conflict, and in that way help end conflict. The most obvious way that it's being done, the most dramatic and visible way that it's being done right now, is through Witness for Peace in Nicaragua. And I suspect that you've, most of you have seen one or another of the newspaper stories about that. Is it Ed Meyer, Wenatchee? Ed Meyer? Who, a doctor who is out in Nicaragua. The basic concept, for those of you who don't know it, is that a group of American Christians called, come together under the name Witness for Peace, has said we are opposed to the U.S. using American money to fund the guerrillas who are killing, torturing, maiming people in Nicaragua. It's not a pro-Sandinista movement. It's simply an action against U.S. funding of the countries and supporting them. And to say no to that movement, they go down in groups of 20 or so at a time and go into those parts of the country where the fighting is most intense. I was down in January, and there had just been several ambushes. Four, five, six, you know, six, 7 people have been killed in each of them. 3 successive ambushes in the town of San Juan de Lama. You may have seen one of the Catholic sisters on television. She was kidnapped for about 8 hours just the day before. Our group of 20 people went into that town. We were the first outside vehicle. As we went in, with knowing that there were 1,000 contras up in the hills, we were a little scared. Actually, we were very safe because they're not stupid enough to kill Americans. It wouldn't be good politics for American money to be used to kill American citizens down there praying for peace. So everybody's been very safe, and it's really not that dangerous, but it's a little scary when you're there. The two most dramatic things that have happened, and which you probably have seen on television, is one, some months ago, when one of the U.S. destroyers was moving toward Nicaragua's territorial waters, a small boat with a group of Witness for Peace moved out. We also had a bunch of newspaper reporters and television people on the boat. But it was a group of Witness for Peace people who thought and prayed and decided that this is what they wanted to do. They moved out toward the destroyer, and with their loudspeaker systems said, please turn around, don't come into Nicaragua's territorial waters. Go home and look at Nicaragua and solve your own problem. And then just last week, in an attempt to help establish a demilitarized zone between Costa Rica and Nicaragua, a group of Witness for Peace people floated down the San Juan River between the two countries and were kidnapped for a few hours. Now, it seems to me that's only one specific strategy. There are dozens and dozens of other ways to work for peace, but this is an attempt to use the techniques of nonviolent direct action to, in some sense, place oneself between warring parties. Now, obviously, with 12,000 guerrillas in Nicaragua, you can't place yourself literally between the Nicaragua people and all of those guerrillas. What you can do is document the torture and violence, and you can make that information available, and in that more general sense, place yourself in between. It seems to me that it would be possible to expand what Witness for Peace is doing in a very major way. And what I wish and pray and think just might happen in the next number of years is that the Christian Church would say, we would develop a volunteer standing Christian Peace Guard. Let's talk about 20,000 people who volunteer 2 years of their life, so you could have 6 months of careful training, and so they're as well trained as not, well, they won't be as well trained as the Marines, but at least really vigorous training, as much sophisticated analysis of logistics and politics and so on as possible, completely committed to nonviolence. and ready to move into situations like Nicaragua or South Africa or Guatemala. I'll give you another example. In Guatemala, there's a parents group, largely mothers, who have been protesting the disappearance of their children. And the government ignored it for a while. And it hasn't doesn't have any particular left-wing political connections. They don't like their children disappearing. But about 6 months ago, it was denounced by the government as subversive. Almost immediately, two of the six women on the top council were killed. One was run off the road while she was driving with her two children. Another one was killed in another way. And an American group called the Peace Brigades International decided they would go down. They would have people who would go with those women 24 hours a day. Since they've done that, nobody else has been killed. Now, there are lots of ways that this kind of basic concept could be developed, I think. It would need sophisticated analysis in every case, but I think it's one new option. It seems to me that both pacifists and just war people have an obligation within their own ethical systems to do it, if they really mean what they've been saying. If pacifists mean what they've been saying, then by golly, they had better be ready to engage in this costly action for the sake of peace, as the soldier does. And unless they do that, it seems to me that it's finally hypocritical. And the just war person, on the other hand, has said all along that it's right to kill for the sake of freedom and peace, only as a last resort. Now, if we have not seriously tried the techniques of Martin Luther King and Gandhi in this kind of nonviolent direct action, I don't see how just war people can claim that they're engaged in last resort kinds of wars. So that both pacifists and just war people, it seems to me, are very much obligated to test this kind of new approach. And I hope that might happen.
Terrific. I can see a new institute of warning. Interesting notion. You might want to come back to that.
One other thing, the Mennonites, as a denomination, are seriously considering the possibility of developing a significant Mennonite version of this.
Okay. Last opening, brief remarks from one half of the anniversary team making work on his 21st wedding anniversary. John Stoner, also peacemaker in various ways.
Listening to Tim and Hillary and Jody talk about all the things that were done here last week, I want to express appreciation for all of that. This makes me feel like coming here to talk about peace is sort of bringing tea to China. You're really working at it, and that's great. There are three things I want to mention: prayer, prophecy, and resistance. Prayer addresses, I think, the problem of many things, but I'll start with the problem of fear. I think that fear of enemies is just almost pervasive in our society, in the U.S. today, and almost globally. I don't know how else to explain so much of what's going on apart from a very deep and gnawing fear, a debilitating fear that invades people's lives. So I think that prayer is the biblical response to that fear. Prayer like that in Psalm 17. Keep me as the apple of your eye. Hide me under the shadow of your wings from the wicked who assail me, from my mortal enemies who surround me. Prayer for God's intervention. Secondly, prophecy, by which I simply mean speaking God's truth clearly and courageously into the situation. I think that the New Testament indicates that all Christians are, at least potentially and probably actually, prepared to be prophets. They are to speak God's word and God's truth into the situation. And So I think that will involve speaking first to the church. Christians. Many methods will have to be used. I have found posters helpful, and sometimes just a few words say something that can generate thought. The one that is over on the wall there, and I have some copies out along, I'm always promoting this one, Modest Proposal for Peace, is post that we printed at MCC about a year ago, and it's traveled around a good bit since then. A Modest Proposal for Peace: let the Christians of the world agree that they will not kill each other. Small beginning, but it would by and large represent improvement over where we have been historically. And it's you know, just the kind of little thing that you can put in your church bulletin board and talk about. I have just happen to have a few copies along. Maybe I'll put some over here.
There's one on the wall over here.
Okay.
There's one out there.
I have some folded copies which would be easier to carry out of here without wrecking them, maybe. A couple of years ago, well, close to 10 now, we made this poster. It's a sin to build a nuclear weapon. Again, rather a direct statement in terms of scientific data and throw weights and missile accuracy and so forth. And we sort of cut through that and made a theological statement about it. Indeed, perhaps a controversial one, but it touches on the heart of what the Catholic bishops have argued about in the last few years and so forth. And this poster says, the taproot of violence in our society today is our intent to use nuclear weapons. Once we have agreed to that, all other evil is minor in comparison until we squarely face the question of our consent to use nuclear weapons. Any hope of large-scale improvement of public morality is doomed to failure. That's also credited to Dick McSorley. The third thing I want to mention is resistance, which I take resistance to be simply a clear and forthright no to that which is evil, that which is wrong. And that could take a variety of forms. For me, it does take the form of war tax resistance and also conscientious objection to personal participation in war.
Okay, range of stuff. It's time for you all to react, ask questions, or add your own peacemaking practices to the pile. The floor is open. Fireplace is open. Whatever. Range of stuff here, right? From day-to-day life to huge moral issues.
John didn't say that he's the author of the text of this one. Let the Christians of the world agree that they will not kill each other. I sent a bunch of those out to different friends. One of them was a pastor, does a lot of counseling, and he ordered a bunch of them and said that a lot of the killing in our world goes on between husbands and wives. But he wanted to use them, especially in his councils.
Pam.
I'd like to hear one of you say what you think we can do in working through the political system.
You want to? Could you focus that question anymore? Tell us where you are on that.
In terms of influencing our lawmakers, or
are you working that way?
Not much yet.
Does it seem to be a promising avenue for you?
Or it seems to me that I could do more than I am.
You want some general comments on, is it worth doing electoral politics with a peacemaking tinge? I'm sure there is a variety of opinion on that. Ron, you want?
My answer is yes. I think that we definitely should work at that level. I don't want to limit myself to that. I definitely want to be involved at other levels. But I mean, take the nuclear freeze proposal. It's gotten a surprisingly long way, enormous discussion in the media, a lot of people committed to it. I think it came surprisingly close to you know, Congress endorsing it. It's a long, slow process, but if we get rid of nuclear weapons or if we reduce them, it'll be because politicians make that decision. Whatever else we also do, it seems to me we need to be involved politically.
I'd like to comment on that and challenge Ron a bit on that. You know, saying politicians will have to do it. Politicians being politicians respond to people, and I think it's a bit illusory to set out to change politicians, let's say change your congressperson, if you haven't also at the same time or first set out to change your pastor or the person who teaches your Sunday school class or the person who sits next to you in the Sunday school class, because those are the people who are the politicians' constituents. And the politicians, they just have their nose to the wind. And they're voting what they think the people want. So I think the best, most important and effective political action is changing the minds of the people you're close to.
Other people want to get in yet?
I just want to make a point. In terms of the nuclear freeze movement, I guess Ron Snyder said in one of his talks the other day that it seemed that the nuclear freeze movement was sort of dormant now. And you just made a statement that you think you came very close to something. Well, I would argue that 5 years ago, one could have predicted the dormancy of the nuclear freeze movement. And I think this points out that we, if we're going to take large-scale political action, we have to look carefully at how we word what we want to do. Most of the nuclear freeze proposals that went to state legislatures, that were sent to the United States Congress, proposed that we freeze, impose a freeze on the research, development, deployment, testing, with little ands in between each of these words, of nuclear weapons. Scientifically, this is not possible to do. It's not possible to have a bilateral, mutually verifiable freeze on all of those things. So one can argue that in voting for this, we realize this is not physically possible to do, but we're making a symbolic statement to the Reagan administration or whoever that we are opposed to nuclear weapons. We want things to stop. Well, why don't we instead frame legislation which says exactly what we want to do, that puts forth a possible agenda for people to react to? Because certainly the Reagan administration is not interested in picking up on the symbolic messages that people such as us want to fill out.
Response? Well, I think it's if you say that nuclear freeze means that you stop testing and deploying nuclear weapons, those two things are fairly specific, and you can tell when you're doing them and you're not doing them. Now, granted, it's in the current climate, it's not completely likely that will happen. But it's not that the target isn't precise or clear. I think that is an example of a limited achievable kind of goal that is a meaningful political agenda.
Well, I think that's that in itself is possible, but that's not the way that freeze initiatives were worded. They asked for a number of things, such as research, and development, which we cannot verify that they're not doing, they cannot verify that we're not doing. Why don't we put something on the table that is very possible? Like say, we believe that we should negotiate under the assumption that we today have parity with the Soviets in any practical nuclear deterrent. Something to that effect, rather than just asking for something we can't do.
Tim, you want to jump in?
I think it brings up the whole issue of realism versus idealism that I hear a lot of talk about. I think both of them are important. It's important to have very realistic, concrete, practical things that we're working for all the time. Specific legislation, results that can be achieved conceivably in the next year, and those are very important for any kind of progress. But that kind of progress also will never happen unless we're doing some idealistic, symbolic things that are asking for what we really want, or speaking the complete truth. So there's a time for politicking and giving and taking, and there's a time for saying, this is what we want, this is where I am. Violence is not good anymore. I want an end to war. And we're not going to have an end to war in the next year. But unless we start unless we say what it is that our ultimate goal is, we're not going to have meaningful short-term results. And we'll only have little token things here and there that don't move us toward that ultimate goal that we have to keep in mind all the time, I think. And it's debatable where the nuclear freeze falls into that.
And unless we also do the consciousness changing that John was talking about, we're not going to be able to get the politicians to make any movement. I don't see why it's an either or. It seems to me we need to do all of those things. And we need to do them all at once. But we can't, as an spend our huge amounts of time doing it.
Other folks?
Yes, sir. Something that, maybe related to this, is that I've heard several times the less disarm, let's cutting ourselves. And that's hard to sell. It's really hard to sell because, you know, in our Constitution says it provides for the common defense of the country. And yeah, you can say we should be more armed with that, et cetera, and water control and so on. But when you say, let's lay down, you know, this thought that binds the whole world so that somebody will listen to you and tune you out. You say, well, the whole world can do it and we can do it this way. That's said more. But I really react really hard when I hear this. Oh, we don't care what happened, how many people are tortured, or how many freedoms are lost, or whatever it is, and so there's our Constitution. People aren't going to listen. The majority of people are not. I think, myself. And I'd like to hear your reaction to that.
That's some of what I was just saying, that yeah, I want to do a lot of things that people are ready to hear, but then in order to maintain my own integrity and in order to maintain the integrity of the movement as a whole on a broader base, some things that I think are very true that people aren't ready to hear need to be said anyway and need to be acted on. My other response to that in terms of providing for the defense of the country relates to what Ron was saying, that there are other ways of defending ourselves that haven't been explored that really could be explored in terms of defense. And as John's been saying all week, that would be very costly, but war is a pretty costly endeavor, too.
Okay, but philosophically, are you willing to be in slavery or something for the situation of some madman with a relay down your arm, some madman to go to the world and put you into slavery? Are you willing to do that?
I would rather do that than contribute to the annihilation of the planet. I would rather do that than pay for mowing down a whole bunch of innocent people with a machine gun.
Then I would ask you the next question. If that is, do the war armed with that, I think the terrible and bad, I might get them down, cut them down, do all that, okay? I'd like to find a practical way of doing it. And the other thing is, at what point do you reach the, say, this is not bad anymore? When you get to the slingshot, bow and arrow, where are you at?
We have several years before we have to deal with that question.
When I go into Seattle and get on the freeway for the first time now, 3 months out in the woods, and I'm driving along at a nice safe speed and somebody zings around me and flips a finger at me and is talking to me through this window, I suddenly realize that, you know, my first reaction is, you dumb SOB, you just cut me off and what are you yelling at me for? You know, So I think, hey, wait a minute, Jeff, what's going on here? You're getting all upset over this. So I have this freeway pacifism thing. You see people throwing a finger at me like this. It's just a little token of what I'm trying to do. I will grant you that it's a lot easier to get back out in the woods where I don't face that. But it's, you know, it happens in the freeway. What do you do when your wife yells at you? You dumb! How did you do that? Or, you know, I walked into a Safeway store and this little kid rammed his cart into my cart. He was pushing the cart for his mother. He's only about that high. And his mother starts screaming at him, you know, and about ready to whack him, and I patted him on the head. She says, "Don't touch my child, you pervert." So, you face this all the time. You know, it isn't a nuclear bomb that's my problem, it's what's in here, you know.
Well, I guess that's what, you know, when I was saying what a couple of other people on this panel have said tonight, that where it seems to me that where practical peacemaking begins is, at least for me in my life, is just in how I relate to other people and how I interact with other people just on my own personal level. And you know, I really feel like for a lot of us who maybe haven't managed to achieve Tim's abstract level of reasoning on this subject, that, you know, just sort of learning to get along or developing a, you know, in our own churches, in our own lives, people, groups of people that can get along together and can discuss things and come to consensus or whatever about things is really where a whole lot of peacemaking begins. And certainly most of us have the experience of meeting some freeway pacifism at one time or another.
It's a good category. We'll use that. Thank you for that. Yes, sir.
This is just a tangential thought, but it seems to me that in some circles there's a tendency to think that conventional war is okay. The real danger is nuclear war. And I think that's, we have to watch that we don't slip into that, because it tends to support the old militaristic thinking. We have to remind ourselves that all of the horrible things that happened in the Second World War and previous wars up to Nagasaki and Hiroshima, the conventional war, and all of the warfare since then has been conventional. So war is the enemy, of which nuclear war is only one of the most excruciating elements.
As a pacifist, I believe that deeply. At the same time, I sure would love to have my kids live in a world that only had to deal with conventional weapons. So that if we could take the one step of getting rid of nuclear weapons, that would be one heck of an important step forward. Although, you're absolutely right, we've killed 40 million people since the end of the Second World War, so that conventional war is pretty bad.
Yes, ma'am. What does it say to us when we have so much of the industry and production in our country today is involved with warfare? We have no shoe manufacturers anymore, very few clothing manufacturers, etc. Farming is slipping.
Well, seems like we're producing weapons. None of the panelists spoke to the war economy set of questions. Do people want to talk about the war economy for a bit? I mean, that certainly raises a whole other set of agendas for peacemaking, it seems to.
What would they be doing in Central America today if we weren't sending all the arms? Supplying so much.
That does have some real practical, presents some very practical alternatives, especially in places where some groups are already set up that are working in conversion projects. There have been various organizations that have dealt with a specific company or a specific town that's dependent on arms manufacturers, and the groups have tried to make it feasible for the economy of that town or of that particular factory to convert to peacetime production.
That is happening.
That's happening in a few places, yeah. And it'd be, that's one of the most exciting things happening, because it's so practical, and it's such a major touchy issue when we're talking about people's livelihoods. And if there are practical ways to help people make a living, help a factory or a town run without having to build bombs or guns, it would be wonderful. And the peacetime kinds of production usually will employ a lot more people and be a lot healthier for the economy than the military production. So it's really a winning situation for everybody when that can happen.
There have been careful studies done on that last point, and it's just beyond dispute, but the spending $1 billion for military procurement is the least efficient way to produce jobs. Anything else you can do almost will produce more jobs in the economy than spending money that way, because military stuff is so high technology, so very few people involved.
And it's also true that it's useless. That is, you're producing stuff that does not get used in the economy, so you're not contributing to the ongoing growth of the economy at all.
Now, there might be some people who would argue with you that all those plants around the country are building cars and forming metal and the high technology and all that might say, wait a minute, folks, what is a good thing? You know, yes, it becomes a weapon, but my job is there to make this thing.
Well, there's a lot of indication that, in fact, that the American economy would fall on its rear end were military spending to be reduced significantly.
If it were just dropped.
If it were just dropped.
But if it were converted into energy-efficient mass transportation and things like that,
that's right.
It'd be a whole different story. And that's something that isn't going to happen in the next year. But it's one of those things that people need to be working on in a very nitty-gritty, practical kind of basis. Real frustrating, slow-going work, but it's great if it gets done.
Yes, up in the top.
Yes.
John, do you want to get
in? Well, I was just going to comment on the question. What does it say to us that this is our economy? And the question came to my mind, well, what would Isaiah say to us, or Jesus say to us? And Isaiah 2, he said this to Israel. Yes, you have cast off your people, the house of Jacob. The land is full of soothsayers, full of sorcerers like the Philistines. They clap hands, clap foreigners by the hand, and they clasp hands like alliances. His land is full of silver and gold and treasures beyond counting. His land is full of horses and chariots without number and militarism. His land is full of idols. They bow down before the work of their hands. The mortal man will be humbled, man brought low. Do not forgive them. Get among the rocks. Hide in the dust at the sight of the terror of Yahweh. So God does take notice of militarism and affluence that goes with it.
My question is just how do any of you view some of the technology that is involved along with NASA on our space program, space shuttle, that is non-military? Or do you feel, because certain parts of it probably is military design, but some of the basic research that's necessary to support those types of programs.
Anyone want to speak to that?
I was just struck a few years ago when, fairly shortly after I was first elected, and I saw the price that it cost to build just one MX missile, and compared that with the amount of money that they were taking out of the education budget. And, you know, for the cost of one missile, it was just amazing to me how much education could occur, you know, with the amount of money and the amount of programs that were being cut. I don't know that I really have a comment other than that, except that it just is, it just blows my mind, really, that one military thing costs just enough to educate a whole town of kids for a year or something like that. And I really think that we need to be working a lot more towards stopping some of those cutbacks and some of those social programs that are so important.
My wife's also a teacher, and she has in her bedroom roll up a sign, I don't know where it came from, but it says someday the Pentagon will have to hold a bake sale
And the schools will have all the money they need.
That's not really where I was going from.
There are non-military research products that come out of military research. That's clear. But as somebody who spends part of his time at a research university, as I do, I have to say that it's frightening to me what's happened over the last 10 or 15 years. That people, not only in the hard sciences, but increasingly in the social sciences as well, who used to have a variety of ways of funding their research projects, National Science Foundation and a variety of other federally participating funding sources, increasingly to do any intellectually groundbreaking kind of work, either in the hard sciences or in the social sciences, have to go to the military for their money, because that's where all the money is. And that, from my point of view, is a very frightening position to be in. So it may be, in fact, that we're getting more byproducts for non-military society out of military research, but it's because partly there is more and more military-funded research being done. You can get Defense Department money, and you can hardly get National Science Foundation money anymore to do stuff.
How could there be a conversion back to that? What are the powers that control that?
It's a societal decision, which will be made at the political level, that we're going to spend our resources differently. But we won't get that unless we have the funding of our things that John's talking about. Mm-hmm. Which means that each of us slugs it out in our own hearts and in our own congregations and in our own electoral district with our own politicians.
And with our own families and children. Last couple of comments. John?
Just along that same line, Herman showed a clip a couple of weeks ago. Part of the I believe it was the Defense Department's own take on the Star Wars technology and the space weapons or defense system. And one of the things that was mentioned in there, it was low key, but it's kind of scary, is that one of their ways that they're selling that is that it will let us use the technology that we have developed.
Right.
So it goes flip side. It goes.
Sir.
You're asking about suggestions for what is happening out there. I would encourage people to check into their local communities to find various kinds of workshops offered through YMCAs, YWCAs, community colleges that deal with managing conflict. And one of the most important things that I see this doing is that it helps us confront ourselves with our own belief system and the way in which we carry that out. And the place where I see that being important is dealing with cooperation versus competition. That when you're dealing with people in relationships, competition is not helpful. When you're dealing with somebody in a game of chess or racquetball, it's okay. But we get confused between when each is possible or each is necessary or wise. And I think getting involved with workshops with groups that deal with those kinds of issues helps us become aware of the kind of dynamics in our own lives and how that does not help us cooperate and understand what peacemaking is all about. Mm-hmm.
Kind of an extension into adult life of what Hillary was talking about doing.
Yeah, in fact, I'd like to see up at Holden Village here some experiential workshops dealing with conflict, controversy, consensus, and cooperation. And an experiential basis, not just the verbal basis that we're constantly on.
Thank you all for coming.